welcome to Yachting International Radio's Yachting USA podcast. I'm your host, Rick Thomas. This podcast is all about the U.S. North American yachting industry. We are here to put it up, push it up, make it better, and in the context of doing so, talk to some really interesting people that have had a long tenure in the game, and today is no exception. I am pleased to be sitting with my friend Michael Moore of Moore & Company, and I think our conversation today will be fascinating, and I am looking forward to getting into this with you, Michael. Thanks for joining me. This is going to be fun.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Good, good. So, listen, we've been in the game a long time, and I thought I was in for a long time, but I was talking to you the other day and realized that you've got me by a decade or so.
Well,
even though they were the same age, I don't know how that works, but
you know, it's a Dorian Gray thing. I'm now representing the grandsons of the people that I first started representing.
Wow.
That's a wonderful thing to have
families.
That I started off with the father, moved to the son, now moved to the grandson.
You know what? Not a lot of people can make that claim.
It's a wonderful thing.
And as we were just speaking a few minutes ago, you're having a good time doing it still.
Exactly.
It's, you know, and that's what it's all about.
Every day is a beautiful thing. I learn something new every day.
That's a good day. And I tell you what, I'm all about that. I think that's part of growing in our careers, growing in our disciplines, what we do. And you do what you do very well.
Well, thank you.
Oh, yeah. We've known each other for a long time. I'm thinking 15, 20 years anyway.
I'd say at least.
This firm has been established now. This year is your 20th year, right?
That's right. 2004.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm.
This month.
Mm-hmm. Cool. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, happy Valentine's Day.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Doesn't it, though? But this isn't how you began. Could you walk us down the path a little bit? You were in maritime law going way back. You're a Florida boy, like me.
Yeah.
And you found a passion for the sea, and I understand aviation.
True.
And just give us a four-minute rundown of
Well, you know, it's actually my, you know, it is my story, and so I like it. And it started out with the law school revelation that there were some very bright people in that room. And I realized for the first time in my academic career that I could not achieve exactly what I wanted to achieve.
Wow.
It just wasn't possible. I mean, I could study 24 hours a day, don't sleep, don't eat, and I probably still would not get a better grade than my best friend in law school, Bobby Gibbons.
Okay. A little competition, a little rivalry there?
He was brilliant. And just to show you how smart he was, when he graduated first in the class, he became a Jesuit priest.
Okay. That's an interesting twist.
We'll talk about that in another podcast.
Okay, fair enough.
Bob is an authority on canon law.
All right.
But Florida is surrounded by water. And it seemed to me there was a need for a good maritime lawyer.
Indeed.
Commerce among nations sounded great. The romance of the sea was wonderful. I'd been introduced to the northeastern part of the United States as a waiter on Cape Cod.
Hmm.
And the whole maritime nautical tradition, the history of America really in microcosm, we started out on Chesapeake Bay, as you know.
Yeah.
That just sounded phenomenal to me, and I just knew it would be something I could do. It'd be a wonderful thing. And I clerked for 2 years with the firm that I had identified as the best law firm in America. I thought it was.
What firm was that?
That was a firm, Burlingham, Underwood, and Lord. Very old guard, white shoe law firm.
Okay.
And going back 140 years by the time I started there, they represented the owners of the Titanic. That's one of the name brand cases.
There you go.
You know, but it was just every case that we had and every case they'd handled just seemed fascinating to me. You know, sinkings, collisions, groundings, buying, selling. And that was night. So when I graduated in June 7th of 1974, I started with them on June 8th of 1974.
Whoa.
Yeah. And
segueing right into
it.
You.
It's been a beautiful thing from day one.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Awesome. When I met you, I think you had recently left Holland & Knight, and that's kind of what mm-hmm. I knew of your background.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you segued into that organization before you started your own.
Yeah, one of those things that I highly recommend to anyone who's trying to figure out their career path. I'd practiced in New York, I'd practiced in Saudi Arabia, I'd stayed with maritime law in Saudi Arabia. Then my wife and I had to decide where we wanted to live when we grew up. And after eliminating several other port cities, San Francisco, New Orleans, Savannah, Charleston, we settled in on Miami. It was kind of a clear choice. Big port, fledgling new cruise industry, enough yachts, and the commercial business was there. So it was perfect. And so
much different city back then than it is
very
today.
Much so. But there was a young man, not so young, well, he probably was young when I met him, but I'd been told to look him up when I was in Saudi Arabia. His name was Ted Arison. And I was told to do that by a guy named Knut Kloster. Knut Kloster had founded a cruise line called Norwegian Cruise Lines. He owned a yacht. He owned a ship called the France, formerly that he renamed Norway. Okay. Caused it quite a little bit of unrest in France, I might add. But he was a brilliant man, and he said, contact my friend Ted Arison when you get to Miami. He's going to go places. So I got to Miami, and I looked him up, and I said, what's your vision? He said, I'm going to build a cruise line. I'm starting with these two boats I have. One was called the Mardi Gras, which is an old boat, not that great, small cruise ship. The other one was the Festival, which he had on charter. And he said, I'm going to call it Carnival Cruise Lines. So that was the beginning of the beginning.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
It's very true. It was amazing.
Yeah, to think back at the start of these things, because we take for granted these shipping lines, these cruise lines, they've been around forever, but they haven't. You know, there's a genesis for each of them and a story behind each of them.
And people say you didn't build that, or it's absolutely false.
Right.
He had nothing. He built that cruise line. He now owns 13 cruise lines within the shell of
Carnival.
His first yacht, I did his first ever personal boat, a 60-foot Hatteras. I bound the closing papers like I would a $200 million LIBOR financing, put his name on there and made it really nice. It was a bound volume, and I gave it to him.
Sweet.
Yeah, and recently someone came to me in my law office and said, I know you said clean out that room that's kind of full of paper at this point, but I thought you might want to keep this. And he gave me that closing volume, and I gave it to Mrs. Arison, who is still alive.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned your office, and I've walked through your office a few times, and I would encourage anybody that has an interest in maritime law, maritime history, to come make a courtesy call and have a look. Every corner is a little gem.
There are
so many cool little things. We stood in front of a map last time I was here for quite a while, and just, you know, that's almost mesmerizing, you know, looking at the world's oceans, what that looks like.
You start to realize what you do for a living.
Yeah,
it's not just, you know, you see it in a different way. I mean, and it's a mantra that I've been thinking of recently about when you're young, you say, well, that old guy he's done well, so he can say that. But it's a truism. Do what you love.
Yep.
The money will follow.
Yep.
And on my wall, I think maybe you've seen the three. I have more than that because my law firm in New York threw out these charts, these paper charts. They were already close to 100 years old.
You showed those to me
when they threw them out. I'm thinking,
crazy.
You're throwing out gold here. As far as I'm concerned, this is
history
gold.
Yeah.
And all of those charts are now about 124 years old, and at the youngest is. And they don't make them anymore.
Right.
It's all electronic now.
Yeah.
But I'd love to imagine the artist who drew the charts, who drew the shoreside reference points. Each artist was different, but each one got a commission. You're being commissioned to draw the port of Newport. You're being commissioned to draw the port of Manhattan, which is the East River and Hudson River. You're being commissioned to draw, fill in the blank. I mean, it was every major port in America, and things were moving. It was fantastic, and they threw them away.
Genuine artistry, really.
Yeah.
And which is a segue into a conversation that I have with captains and people in this industry where we've seen this industry evolve to almost exclusive electronic charts.
Right.
And yet, you know, the boats are still built with map storage and big map tables. And I'm a big advocate of old school in that way. You ought to learn how to use a compass and sextant and be able to use charts and navigate with charts because, you know, what happens if, God forbid, GPS goes down for a while or you lose your electronics? You still have a seaworthy vessel. You want to be able to navigate it, right?
Celestial navigation. What if you're in a lifeboat?
What about that? Yeah. And there's some pretty cool stories about people in lifeboats.
Do you remember the first time you ever noticed that one of the stars in the heavens was not moving?
Yeah, that was a while ago. But when I was actually working offshore, I loved the night shift. I would take the 11:30 to 11:30 shift.
Okay.
And anytime I've delivered boats or been on boats where I had the privilege or luxury of standing watch, the dog watch is mine.
There you go.
4 a.m. in the morning, cup of coffee at the helm. And the stars absolutely are stunning, spectacular. Yeah. And you do start noticing the nighttime sky and how things change and how things don't.
And I remember lying on a deck of a sailboat, not having the background that you do. I'm not a sailor. I did not go to the academies. I did not go to the Naval Academy or one of the service academies. I think it's a part of my success, because I've always hired people that knew what they were talking about. I never assumed I did.
Right, right.
And so I always hired great experts, and whether it was in navigation or rules of the sea or rules of the navigable road, the coal regs, the collision regulations, or MARPOL violations, I always hire the best of the best that I can identify to be my expert.
Perfect.
Yeah.
That's what you want. Well, it's interesting. Yeah. My maritime history goes back to 1979, 1980. I went to the Florida Institute of Technology, FIT, in the Jensen Beach campus.
Nice.
It was a small college. And I went into their underwater technology program. My parents wanted me to go to college. I was accepted to UF and USF. And I wanted to go to work. And it was stupid me. And we made a compromise. And I did a 2-year degree program, which was really unique in underwater technology. And it was all about commercial diving.
Wow.
But full maritime skills and everything else associated with the degree program. And that got me on track to get out in the Gulf of Mexico. And I spent 4 years in the Gulf commercial diving. What was my takeaway was, looking back, how applicable that time at sea was in understanding what it is to be on the ocean, live on the ocean, work on the ocean, deal with the environment of the ocean, what it does.
It was fantastic.
The perspective you have, the understanding you have, to see the ocean one morning, a mill pond where you could literally water ski between the oil rigs, and 48 hours later, we're in 6-7 meter seas.
Oh, yeah.
It'll get your attention real quick.
You know, it's totally true. You're also see your place in the grand scheme of the cosmos. You know, you're really insignificant, but at the same time, you kind of realize how powerful as a person you are. You're a human, and yet the world is your oyster in the sense that, as an American, there's no limits to what you. I grew up thinking there was no limits to what I could achieve, but I also had parents who always told me, just follow your dreams, Michael. Don't try to assume that somebody else's dream is going to work for you.
No, exactly.
Yeah. You do it. I remember that was very good advice. Yeah. It's always follow. That's been one of my mantras.
So, Michael, one of the objectives I have in doing this podcast, and I would have never guessed, 2-3 years ago, I'd be doing this podcast. And ironically enough, 2 years ago at the Palm Beach Boat Show, I'm walking the dock with Kit Dennison. I had just left Nautical Structures after 35 years. And
was that long?
No,
I had no idea.
3.5 decades.
I think I told you, I always specced Nautical Structures in new build constructions.
I had the
opportunity to spec, which, everybody does it differently. Everybody has a team that's different. But in some occasions, I would have the opportunity to say, which passerelle would you like, or which gangway, or whatever.
Right, right.
And I'd say, check out Nautical Structures. I mean, they just stay put in a hurricane. They're great. Okay,
pay attention, everybody. That's how this industry works.
No, that's right.
It's how this industry works.
Totally the way it works. Small industry.
And a little segue there. I started that in the back of my dad's shop when I left the diving industry. And that's a whole other podcast do one day.
Yeah.
It was a slow build, and then I hooked up with a great gentleman by the name of Bob Boleen, who was at the time working for my biggest competitor. And he joined with me. We sat down and put the deal together at the Miami Boat Show.
I love
How about
it.
That? And we decided we're going to combine our efforts. He was building boats with Kit Denison at Denison for a long time. He understood shipbuilding. And of course, I came from my maritime background. And we said, we're going to build the very best of the best that we know how to do. And we did. Yeah. And, you know, there's something to be said about setting the bar high. And you do it, you realize that not everybody is your client, but that's okay. There's enough other companies that feed the middle ground and the mediocrity part. And this industry does have some mediocre product as well, but it's an aspiration to try to achieve a high standard and set that high standard.
Go for the best.
So Kit and I were walking the docks during the Palm Beach Boat Show 2 years ago, and he said to me, you know, Rick, you got to consider doing your own podcast.
I remember hearing your voice. I heard this voice that I did not recognize overlay on a video of what is called The Crossing.
Oh, yeah.
Which you participated in, but maybe your listeners might not. But it was a crossing from Bimini to Palm Beach, effectively south of Palm Beach,
by paddle miles.
Boat. By paddle boat.
Paddle boards. Yep, and kayaks, but mostly paddle boards.
You paddle the whole way. It was a paddle, and that was The Crossing, designed to raise money for cystic fibrosis. And that sounded like a cool thing. Anything that's on the water, I like. And my charity, these people had come to me, and I said, I think it's a great fit. It's a perfect fit for us. There was one guy who was the champion of the idea, Dick Seidenspinner.
Good guy.
But when I heard the voiceover, it was your voice. I said, that's a great radio voice.
I've done it 2 years with Seakeeper Society. We'll circle back to Seakeepers later in this conversation. I want to talk about that. But to your point, it was my first time, and we went over with a film crew, and they mic'd me up, and I completely forgot. It was, you know, the trip over was only 2 hours.
Cool.
The trip back was almost 17 hours.
I've seen
what people don't understand is my boat, for instance, was leading Team Seakeepers, and I was the navigator, essentially, and the helmsman, cruising at a whopping 4 to 5 knots. Mostly four.
Mostly on the Gulf Stream, I guess.
Well, the Gulf Stream moved us up maybe almost to six, but that was a period of time.
Sure.
We leave the island at midnight. It's dark, and there was 180 paddlers in the water. What could possibly go wrong? But what an experience. And you touched on that. My wife, Lisa, had cystic fibrosis, passed away in 2018.
I'm aware of this.
And so for me and my boys, it really was and is a charity and a cause. Celeb, you know, it's important to us, and it's great to put a spotlight on it and see the gene therapy and things that are being done now that are helping people with CF. And we love the idea of doing something with our boat on the ocean that raises money for a cause that's something beyond ourselves and something we can tangibly identify with. And yes, we're in it again this year.
Those little boats, I understand. I mean, I'm a part of it, but they don't tell me everything that are now carrying loggers.
Yeah.
Which map the ocean
seabed 2030.
Seabed 2030.
My boat surface interval has one.
Seabed 2030 came onto our radar screen on September 22nd, 1922. Excuse me, 2022.
I was going to say.
Excuse me. In London, on a beautiful building that looks like it's broken glass, and the English call it the Shard.
The Shard, yes.
It was a wonderful party, and into our lives walked this man named Jamie McMichael Phillips, and one of my colleagues says, you need to meet this guy. He's got a great program. There's a lot to be said about that. We can talk about that, too. But there's a lot to be talking about.
Yes, there is.
We are the world.
Yes, we are the world.
It's the blue part.
Let's not break into song right now, though, shall we?
Lionel Richie on the phone.
Hey, so segueing back, you know, it's here I am doing this podcast, and this podcast really is about.
You have a face for radio. You have a face that's made for radio.
Perfect face for radio, absolutely. You know, I spent an hour and a half doing my hair earlier today just to get it right. But no, my goal is to lift up the North American yachting industry. I want to say North American because while the name of the podcast is Yachting USA, it's really about the North American, because the Canadian yachting industry is real and tangible, and they have a huge contribution in our history, and I think they've got a good place in our future, so I don't want to exclude our friends to the north.
Right.
Besides, they come down here every winter and spend a lot of money. I don't pay personal income tax in Florida because of the Canadians.
We have a warm spot in our heart.
We love these guys. Absolutely. So one of the things I'm doing, Michael, is I'm going back in history because I do go back in the yachting industry now 37 years.
Yes.
And when I got involved in yachting and I started actually building equipment, I was supplying, when I say I should be careful, nautical structures. I use the term interchangeably, but there's a lot of great people at Nautical. I don't want to take anything away from that. We were supplying cool equipment to shipyards around the world, and but predominantly in the United States, mm-hmm. and Canada. And at that time, I currently count 42 shipyards that were building vessels, cruiser vessels, 75, 80 feet and larger.
Right.
32 or 34 of them were building over 100 foot.
Wow.
You know, really cool history when you look at what was happening out west, and Westport Shipyard was building a bunch of Jack Sarin hulls and supplying a bunch of other shipyards with hulls and superstructures that got turned into the Crescent Beach Boatyard, the Sovereign, the North Coast. You know, these other shipyards were fed by a company by the name of Westport that was owned by Rick and Randy Rust.
Wow.
You know,
hearing you say this, if you don't mind a bit of an interjection.
Sure.
But this is a wonderful history of the yacht world that I think is, everyone has that piece that is meaningful and should be meaningful to anyone paying attention of, you know, kind of the how did we get here kind of question. So
yep.
I remember a man coming to me and basically saying, I've seen the future of yachting. And I said, well, you're the largest Hatteras dealer that I know of, I think maybe in the entire network. What do you think? He says, you know, Hatteras does not want to build these boats.
Right.
But I've seen the boat that I've wanted to build as a Hatteras, and they're not interested. So I'm going to leave Hatteras and build this vessel called Golden Delicious. I said, Golden Delicious. That sounds like an apple.
He says,
he's an apple farmer.
Okay.
Wow. He said, but I pulled up alongside him, and I asked him where he built this boat, and he said, a place called Westport. Went down to Westport. They didn't tell us any of the stuff that you're mentioning.
Okay.
What we understood is that they did work boats and northwest work boats.
They
strong,
did that too.
Sturdy,
absolutely
wonderful vessels. But we wanted to build them to build yachts, and Rick and Randy weren't interested. We created a yacht brand called West, and we started cranking out yachts. My client was the client, and I was the lawyer for the client. I trademarked the name West Ship. And anyway, make a long story short, the West Ship brand was born, and then, of course, when Orrin Edson came along, bought Westport, he also then bought West Ship.
West Ship was built in Tampa, right?
No, you're thinking of Windship.
Windship, okay.
But the Westport thing and the Westship thing was all out there with the Rick and Randy origins.
Okay, yeah.
And the origins of what it is today, which is a wonderful American yacht builder.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, it's fun, too, and we're going to explore this. I've already got a commitment from my friend Daryl Wakefield to sit with me.
Oh, that's the man.
He's a great guy. And this is the part where, YPY, are you paying attention? We're going to be talking to you guys, too. His dad, Earl Wakefield, was building at Admiral Marine Works. And they were building some of the biggest fiberglass yachts in the world.
I remember.
You know, yep. Aviva,
yep.
Roxana. They built a really cool composite boat called Plum Duff. They were cutting edge, cool technology. And unfortunately, like so many shipyards, they stumbled. Earl stopped. Daryl was running the yard. Things became challenging. Orrin Edson came in, as you well know, bought out Rick and Randy. And he asked Daryl to join his company. And Daryl went through the Edson phase. And when Edson Schwest came in and acquired them, stayed on. He's tenacious. He's got a great head for boat building. He's just a gentleman in the industry.
Totally.
We'll have fun talking about him.
Yep, all the above. Yep.
But where I'm going with this is that fast forward to 2024.
Okay.
And there's
that's this year.
That's right now. And there's less than 10 shipyards in North America building cruiser vessels.
Wow.
Less than 10. I was going to say 6, 5, but there might be a couple I'm missing here that are building some boats. So I want to be a little careful and a little conservative. But imagine losing 75 or 80% of your infrastructure over three decades, and you have to go, wow. I mean, Palmer Johnson, gone. Christensen, gone. Lazare Yachts, gone. Yep. Northern Marine, gone. Crescent Boat Builders, gone. Now Crescent Custom Yachts has just finished a Christensen haul, and they've got a beautiful boat they delivered. But they're there, and we hope they maintain and become successful. But you just go down the list, and you realize Trinity. Wow, all the boats that Trinity built, gone. And we now are a completely different yachting industry today than we were. And it's maybe parts of that are inevitable. Costs of labor are high. You can go to China, you can go to Taiwan, you can go to Turkey, and you can get some pretty good quality boats built with cheap labor. That therein lies the conversation one day of, should there be some more protectionism in the United States? The Jones Act certainly was one layer of protection, does some things for us, but not a lot. There's a lot of boat dealers who might hear this podcast that will say, Rick, shut up.
Did you say the Jones Act?
The Jones Act. That? I mentioned the Jones Act. That's a conversation, too, because it has so much influence, particularly on the larger boats we deal with.
Well, I think that to your earlier point, every single one of those yacht builders was an American yacht builder that they thought that the Jones Act would protect them. It actually sank them. What happens is that, in my view.
That's what we're talking.
It's my view. Because I think people have a very short time frame and not enough respect for history and people that make history and that move markets and do things that are, we get the benefits of. Now, for example, more than 100 years ago, there was, you mentioned it before the podcast actually started, the Limitation of Liability Act.
Right.
That was passed in 1851. That was designed to protect American shipping. In other words, the idea was that if your ship sank, you should not lose everything in that loss. So it protected you to the value of the vessel that sank. Your limitation fund would be the value of the thing that sank after the sinking.
Right.
And that was the fund that was created, the Limitation Liability Act. That was also the year, 1851, of something called the America's Cup. My very tenuous connection between the two is that they're both maritime, both legendary. They're both still here.
There's less than 10 shipyards in North America building cruise serve vessels.
Wow.
Less than 10. I was going to say five, but there might be a couple I'm missing here that are they're building some boats. So I want to be a little careful, a little conservative. But imagine losing 75 or 80% of your infrastructure over three decades, and you have to go, wow. I mean, Palmer Johnson, gone. Christensen, gone. Lazare Yachts, gone.
Yep.
Northern Marine, gone. Crescent Boat Builders, gone. Now Crescent Custom Yachts has just finished a Christensen haul, and they've got a beautiful boat they delivered. But they're there, and we hope they maintain and become successful. But you just go down the list, and you realize Trinity. Wow, all the boats that Trinity built, gone. And we now are a completely different yachting industry today than we were. And it's maybe parts of that are inevitable. Costs of labor are high. You can go to China, you can go to Taiwan, you can go to Turkey, and you can get some pretty good quality boats built with cheap labor. That therein lies the conversation one day of, should there be some more protectionism in the United States? The Jones Act certainly was one layer of protection, does some things for us, but not a lot. There's a lot of boat dealers who might hear this podcast that will say, Rick, shut up.
Did you say the Jones Act?
The Jones Act. I mentioned the Jones Act. That's a conversation, too, because it has so much influence, particularly on the larger boats we deal with.
Oh, I think that to your earlier point, every single one of those yacht builders was an American yacht builder that they thought that the Jones Act would protect them. It actually sank them. What happens is that, in my view.
That's what we're talking.
It's my view. Because I think people have a very short time frame and not enough respect for history and people that make history and that move markets and do things that are, we get the benefits of. Now, for example, more than 100 years ago, there was, you mentioned it before the podcast actually started, the Limitation of Liability Act.
Right.
That was passed in 1851. That was designed to protect American shipping. In other words, the idea was that if your ship sank, you should not lose everything in that loss. So it protected you to the value of the vessel that sank. Your limitation fund would be the value of the thing that sank after the sinking.
Right.
And that was the fund that was created, the Limitation Liability Act. That was also the year, 1851, of something called the America's Cup. My very tenuous connection between the two is that they're both maritime, both legendary. They're both still here.
There you go.
America's Cup right now is one of the most dynamic, forward-thinking, creative, technologically oriented. You can talk about the falling cats as being something, but frankly, I see no difference between a foiling cat in the America's Cup than a board in the crossing from Bimini to Palm Beach.
There you go.
They're all part of the same wonderful global world that we live in. In fact, the crossing vessels would probably be auxiliary vessels on yachts.
That's right.
But the yacht world as a whole, the yacht world gave birth to the America's Cup. It was the yachting class that started regattas. They used to, back in the day, before August, the royal families, in August, of course, as we all know, they would go up to Scotland to shoot birds. But before that, they would sail in the Solent. And they would go down to the Solent south of Southampton and north of the Isle of Wight and have their races. But out of all of that, wind and sail and sailboats arose the yacht world.
Yeah.
And it's not like these things are not, they're not happenstance. If you look at the great yachting events, it's not an accident that the greatest boat shows are on the best places to be on Earth at the time they happen. What better place to be on Earth than Miami in the month of February?
There you go.
The Miami Boat Show.
Miami, Monica's not bad in September.
The end of the season, everyone's enjoyed their summer cruising. The September has arrived. The Mistrals have not yet arrived. It's starting to get a little chilly. Some days it can be actually very hot, that last vestige of heat in the summer.
Yep.
But everything's happening right there. And that's why it becomes this magical industry that everyone loves. They can't describe it very well. They kind of sense it. They kind of feel it. But whether you're in Palm Beach in March or Fort Lauderdale in October, the weather's perfect both ends of the spectrum there. It's not happenstance. Some of it's geographic. I got that. But there's a lot of, the world is geographic. So you're part of that geometry or geographical location do you want to grab onto. So my point is, in a very short period of time, we've talked about someone seeing the apple farmer, who named his yacht, of course, Golden Delicious,
right,
is embracing his success in life. He not only raised apples, he raised a certain type of apple. But what did he want to do after he had earned it and after he had made his mark and after he had made his fortune? He said, I'm going to design a boat that I can enjoy. So it had no outside rail and no outside walkways because it's too cold.
Right.
In the Pacific
Northwest. Yeah.
And the draft was shallow because there's a lot of shoals and rocks in that part of the world. He designed, in his own apple orchard mind, he's probably brilliant, apple farmer brain, the perfect boat that became almost a standard in the yacht world.
There you
First
go.
First built by Westport.
Yeah.
American build. Competitive American build. They're a success story. They're solid. They shoot their lights out. They're 40 meters, what they call their 40 meters, which is the way they describe their built class yachts,
right. Yep.
As opposed to 130 meters, which is kind of their length overall. But all of these things fascinate me because they are part of that mosaic of the world we live in. You're talking about uplifting the North American yacht world. I would probably start by getting rid of the Jones Act. That'd be the first thing.
I was going to ask you about that.
Tillman Fertitta, the great yachtsman from Houston and the owner of a restaurant chain and think probably other things, and forgive me, he'll forgive me for not knowing.
He built Boardwalk
Empire. Right. But he's the one that got some exceptions to the Jones Act.
Yes.
Basically because his yachts were bigger than the what when the people wrote the Jones Act, they couldn't imagine a yacht being that big. And so they wrote it where it would be a ship.
Right.
And so he had the wealth to actually get exceptions. They should do away with the Jones Act. It's a complete disaster. It doesn't protect anybody. It runs the business offshore.
It does at that.
Here's a question. Do you want to buy something that costs $100 here or get the same thing by paying $50 there?
It's not often a hard decision.
I mean, everybody lives in life in their enlightened self-interest.
Yeah.
I guarantee you Westport competes because it's competitive. It meets everything head on. It's not because of the Jones Act.
No.
It's because of the way they build and the way they run and the way people are, you know. But the largest yacht I know, for example, in California, the Yachtsman was originally built in Italy. Nothing wrong with Italy until someone got in that billionaire's face and said, I want to build you a yacht that will make the one you have look like a second-class citizen. And he did. They've done that, and he's now a loyal customer of Delta.
Delta. Yeah. I love it.
So, you know, we hope, because, I mean, also, a lot of things along the way that you mentioned, some of the failures of the North American yachting world, and I just think we're into that. We're in one of those inflection points. What did you say you did in 1979 earlier?
I went to school. I started commercial diving. Yeah.
So that's when you came out of school?
I came out of school in 1980.
1979, if you Googled 1979, you would find that like 1998, it was one of those years where everything changed. That was the Iranian Revolution. That was
the hostages.
Yeah. The Islamic Revolution, the great migration of people all over the world. It was the OPEC is now underway. The oil producing nations were in charge.
We had just had gas lines and ridiculously expensive fuel.
Other things happened that year, but it was a major year.
Yep.
Having to do with some of the things in the Middle East. A lot of it was Middle East related.
Were you in Saudi at the time?
I was there till November of 79, the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the return of Ayatollah Khomeini.
What a time to be over there in the Middle East.
In a beautiful country that was, in my view anyway, but that was the year of the Al-Khobar Towers incident. That was the year that the radicals took over the holy city of Mecca.
Mecca, right.
And that was the year they bombed the Marine barracks in Lebanon.
Right, yeah.
I mean, the whole world was in upheaval almost overnight, and then along came Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I tell you what, and things turned around.
It's true, and I mean, no one wants, a lot of people don't want to admit it because of their political affiliations and so forth, but you know, it's true.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. You can have, you know, there's no such thing as your truth. There's truth and there's falsity. You just need to go through life trying to figure out the difference.
And it's funny how you look at success and what that looks like. So for instance, Reagan comes into office and fairly quickly we started becoming more energy self-sufficient and fuel and oil costs were being reduced. And guess what happens when you're exploring offshore for oil and all of a sudden oil costs get reduced? They stop exploring. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
We'll leave it in the ground and wait for a time when it's more profitable, take it out of the ground. And that's what drove me out of the oil fields and commercial diving and right into the lap of yachting. So, you know, it's unintended consequences. Change course. Pivot. You have to do what you have to do,
right? You think in 1980, which was 34 years ago. Is that 44 years ago?
44 years ago.
With Ted Arison, who became the great billionaire who Acosta's, that family and that, and Acosta has a company, he now owns 13 cruise lines.
Right.
Buying a 60-foot Hatteras.
That was a big boat back then, too, by the way.
Yeah. But I think that the world was changing in ways, I mean, that was 79, 80. As you said, South Florida was a very different place. Well, the yacht world in America, as we knew it, was a different place. Somewhere not too long after that, you had sort of the Brunswick blow up. The Brunswick was suddenly acquiring yacht builders or boat builders. I don't know that they ever really made that transition into yachts.
Not well.
In our times, Rick, I mean, you must be thinking also, that's your subject matter, thinking about Marine Max, the advent of Marine Max.
Oh, absolutely. Up in Clearwater. I lived in their backyard when that was coming together.
I remember when they came online, you could buy them for $4 a share.
Wow.
I don't know what it is today, but I suspect
it's a lot more than $4 a share, that's for sure.
And great people. And they are in the yacht world.
Yeah. I hope to have the opportunity to speak with Chuck one day.
I think Chuck Cashman is a very articulate spokesperson for Marine Max. I don't know the structure of marine backs. I don't know exactly who's who and what's what there. Well, but I know who Chuck Cashman is, and I don't need to know all that other stuff.
Right, right.
Because if I need something, I'm going to go to him first.
There you go. And that's also the beauty of this industry. It's a people industry.
It's a consolidation of the brokerage side of our industry. And then you have the consolidation of the marina side. And we have a lot of that going on.
Right. So one of the things you hear me talk about, you mentioned brokerage, you mentioned marine backs, the way this industry has evolved. The health of our industry is what I think needs to be in focus. It's a different industry, and that's all right. Every industry changes. We know that, we accept that, and we expect that. And we may never get back to the days we were building so many yachts in the United States, but we are still the dominant force in the world for yachting, without a doubt, period. And companies like Marine Max and companies like Safe Harbor and what you see John and Michael Kelly doing with the Bradford organization and what they're rolling up and what they're building. There's a good momentum going that I think we pay attention to, which is ideally good for the business, good for the industry. So when I start looking at what this looks like, one of the things I talk about is what I call my sacred triad, the sacred trinity, if you want to go down that path. There are three pillars, I think, of essential elements that make this industry healthy. Okay. If these pillars are healthy, the industry tends to be healthy.
Okay.
One is the owners.
Right.
And people would probably listen to this podcast and say, the owners, come on, Rick. I mean, they're billionaires, millionaires. Why are you worried about them? It's because there's so few of them, so few high net worth individuals that could afford to buy a boat that actually do. It's a ridiculous small percentage. And so when you realize you're dealing with anywhere from 4 to 6% of all that high net worth individuals that are our customers, you don't have to piss off very many of them to all of a sudden see what that effect has on our industry.
Right.
And imagine our industry if all of a sudden all these guys say, screw it, I'm just going to charter a boat if I want to be in the ocean. Buying a boat, owning a boat doesn't make any sense.
I've learned in the yacht world, Rick, that the very rich are different from you and me.
They got more money than you and I have.
Exactly.
But that aside, I've made good friendships with some very wealthy people. That's right. That's true.
They have more money.
They have more money.
Now, without the owners, there is nothing
for the yacht world. There's no industry.
Now, you also have this metric. At the very top, you have between 2,500 to 3,200 billionaires in the world. At the base of the entry-level yachtsman, you have 187,000 in the world, people worth more than 32 million.
There you go.
Only.
Yeah.
So that's your pyramid, and of course, I totally agree that it is a luxury thing. It's actually evolving beyond luxury as we see yacht ownership become more merging with the scientific world and the philanthropic world, the doing better with yachting world. There's a lot of newcomers to that initiative, but as far as I'm concerned, that's more the merrier. You can't have enough. There are going to be breakthroughs, and we're having breakthroughs every day.
So we have to keep them in the game. And,
I totally agree.
In your practice, Michael, you talk to these guys on a daily basis. You hear the stories. I know you got client attorney privilege, so you're limited as to what you can share. But I'm certain you have some perspective that talks to why owners get in and stay in and why owners get out.
Right.
And as an industry, what can we do better? What can we do to keep these boys and girls in the game with us?
You know, I really do think that it's every successful organization in the yacht world is no different from any other industry. To a great extent, it is the execution of what your core business is. You know, what is your core competency? You stay inside that envelope of your core competency, and you have what I think of as the kind of a three C's of competency is one, commitment is another, and character. So you look at these builders, Fed ship, European build, okay, I got that, you do too. Lursen, European build.
Yep.
But there is a certain three C's of those businesses. They do have competency. They have commitment to what they do. They are unabashed. They're building the best yachts they can build.
Yep.
And then they have character. You don't see anybody saying, you know, that they did this or fiddled there or cut this corner or cut that corner. Somebody just learned about it. I think that the American yacht building world is, I don't know, we had a patch there and it seemed like every day there'd be another marina, but another boat yard, another rump yard, I called it, another, you know, they're going to build two boats or this or that.
Yeah.
But I think there's that's sorted out. And now there's a, we're going to start to enter a new day, which I think is, it's a world of, you know, it's a lot of the smaller world, smaller boats are suddenly starting to come up. I'm talking about the small sailboats, the small, even as low as surfboards, mm-hmm. windsurfers, people getting out on the water, enjoying boating. And the COVID period kind of proved that was a great way to enjoy your life.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what's going on around you.
Yeah.
And now we're entering into this new kind of phase that I hope will result in the, you know, the resurgence of some of those organizations you mentioned that I thought were wonderful.
They were, and they are. And so, for instance, just speaking to what you just touched on, Delta Marine, for instance, I understand they have four or five new projects now. Fantastic.
Wow. Yeah.
That shipyard, unless you spend some time and understand what they do and how they do it, may not realize that they build to a standard that's comparable to Northern Europe. They really
right.
do.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I've been involved in dozens
right.
of builds with Delta over 30 years. And the attention to detail and the pride that they put into their product is tangible. It's real. Berger Boat Company, what Jim and Ron are doing up there in Manitowoc right now under Howard's tutelage, they're maintaining that pedigree. They've got a 55-meter boat right now that's
never
going through.
Let their standards suffer.
Nope. And, of course, Westport, I would say the same thing. I'd like to see what Tim Charles did with that, with the boat that Crescent just built. I understand that it's pretty spectacular. So here we've got, one, two, three, four examples of builders
right.
that are doing well.
Ollie Hand, plus 354-623.
That's all right.
That can mean that's Finland, so it could be the volcano has blown again or...
Boom.
Just kidding.
So...
We'll call him back, obviously.
No problem. So the messaging, part of this messaging is to, you know, give these guys a chance. You know, if you're considering the acquisition of a vessel through brokerage, look at those brands. They're good brands. If you're really serious about building new, take a fresh look, because... It's what we need as an industry is to prop up, you know, the shipyards have to stand on their own 2 feet, no question about it. But if we can help push business their way, I think it's a win-win for everybody in the industry, in mm-hmm. the U.S., North American industry for sure.
I would like to comment on that to, in a sense that I think maybe one of the things that I know you've been historically involved with the International Superyacht Society.
I have.
I think it's one of the purest organizations. It's been around three decades. It has the greatest, honest voice in the industry for a trade organization of that size and sort.
It's pure. It has
it's
no
pure.
Real agenda.
That's right. It's never compromised its, you know, its standards, its principles. There have been a lot of these magazines that have, you know, they create these their own award shows and so forth. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with those. I just don't know enough about them. But the ISS is not a magazine. Mm. It's not... trying to incur favor with any particular builder.
No.
So what I see, I think now with the advent of this new, there's a new committee, chaired, incidentally, by Ron Cleveringa.
There you go.
But it's going to be the true interface, I hope, between the American and international, but American needs an interface with the flag states and the flag states with the IMO. I think the IMO is not an organization that is fully appreciated in the yacht world, but it is the number one most important organization in the world for maritime affairs.
In the yacht world, and so correct forth. Me if I'm wrong, is it just Seabass that has a seat at the IMO?
Yeah, I think Seabass has some kind of an affiliate representation there, and there's one person, but I really think that the way to understand this idea One thing I've noticed in so many industries, and particularly the yacht world, is no exception. Teamwork is just going to be the thing that rules the day. And so every flag state is a competitor, but every flag state also is a part of the same global regime of how are all these vessels out there? Are they just privately owned for private pleasure? Or are they commercially owned to carry people, to carry the public? You have all these different divisions and subdivisions. The ultimate expression on passengers would be the cruise industry. And of course, you have cargo, which is the way 85% of all commerce is conducted is still conducted on the oceans or something. There's a number like that. It's huge.
Yep.
My point, though, is that IMO is the body. And, they, you know, they're like most legislative bodies. You know, the Exxon Valdez happens. They pass MARPOL.
Right.
You know.
I don't want to pass this opportunity. You actually litigated with the Exxon Valdez.
I did, actually. I did. You know, it's just one of those things. The phone rings. You can't explain it. And it's Exxon calling. And they had this terrible event in Prince William Sound. And, you know, there were cases filed in Florida. And I handled the Florida cases. You know, I was consulted and liaised with the big team. I mean, Exxon's based in Houston, but there was that team, and then there was a team up in, I think it was Tennessee, that was kind of running the show. But yeah, I had the Florida cases. I handled all of them.
Had been fascinating.
Yeah. You know, it's great. I mean, it's a, and one, it's what's fascinating about it, and it's funny because you want to raise the North American yacht building organization. I think that out of the, by way of comparison, out of the disasters of the Torrey Canyon, the Argo Merchant, the Amoco Cadiz, and ultimately the Exxon Valdez, these are all things that made the world a better place, ultimately. These are all led to legislation, the Maritime Oil Pollution Act, the MARPOL Act.
MARPOL Act, right.
Those things have changed the world. It's made the world waters materially cleaner. The yacht world has its own needs like that. They're currently not being represented. I mean, there's a titular affiliation with one person, but I'm talking about getting the yacht world fully integrated.
There's no real strong voice for the yacht industry.
Really.
And
the ISS is the only organization in the world that can actually serve that function. And so this committee has already got a member from Ocean Co on it, for example. There's some big coming, Rasmussen and others.
It's international, and that's right. You know, and there's no getting away from the fact that it's a very international industry.
Cleveringa is, of course, Berger Boat Company.
Love it.
But I think, you know, we're all on this planet. We're all doing our thing. But the Americans, I mean, I think it's 95% of the boats registered in the Cayman Islands are beneficially owned by Americans.
Yeah. It's still a dominant need. You know, I was in a podcast with Rhea before the holidays, and she asked the question, you know, Fort Lauderdale, Monaco, what's really the yachting capital of the world?
You want to raise the North American yacht building organization. I think that out of the, by way of comparison, out of the disasters of the Torrey Canyon, the Argo Merchant, the Amoco Cadiz, and ultimately the Exxon Valdez, these are all things that made the world a better place, ultimately. These are all led to legislation, the Maritime Oil Pollution Act, MARPOL Act.
MARPOL Act, right.
Those things have changed the world. It's made the world waters materially cleaner. The yacht world has its own needs like that. They're currently not being represented. I mean, there's a titular affiliation with one person, but I'm talking about getting the yacht world fully integrated.
There's no real strong voice for the yachting industry.
Really.
And
the ISS is the only organization in the world that can actually serve that function. And so this committee has already got a member from Ocean Co on it, for example. There's some big coming, Rasmussen and others.
It's international, and there's no getting away from the fact that it's a very international industry.
Cleveringa is, of course, Berger Boat Company.
Love it.
But I think, you know, we're all on this planet. We're all doing our thing. But the Americans, I mean, I think it's 95% of the boats registered in the Cayman Islands are owned, beneficially owned by Americans.
Yep. It's still a dominant need. You know, I was in a podcast with Rhea before the holidays, and she asked the question, you know, Fort Lauderdale, Monaco, what's really the yachting capital of the world? And, you know, I didn't hesitate. It's like, it's not even close. Fort Lauderdale, for sure. Southeast Florida, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You can stack whatever metrics you want. This is still the yachting capital of the world. And as such, we have a lot of influence. I love history, right? So go back to the days that I was doing business with Broward Marine. By the way, Ron Cleveringa and I met 30 years ago when I was up in Chicago, when I learned I was going to be a father for the first time. He was an engineer up in Sagatok with Broward up north.
Yeah, out of town.
He was. I was doing projects with Kenny Dennison down here in Fort Lauderdale, and I remember walking into his office one day and being introduced to Richard Hine.
Now, of course.
Those of us who know, Richard went on, after spending a couple years at Broward, building some pretty cool boats, Pegasus, Britannia, there's a couple others that were notable. He started A Group in Monaco, and of course that segued into Oceanco.
Yep.
And, you know, so
I remember meeting him for the first time up in a place called Blasterdam.
Oh, there you go.
But, you know, it's all those, they had run into some trouble. They had some serious cash flow problems. And my sort of way of approaching things is to say, tell me again what you think the problem is. Cash flow. I said, okay, operative word, cash. All right. So why don't we just get a bunch of cash and fly to Blasterdam, see if we can take care of the problem.
Problem solved, right?
Problem solved.
There you go.
Because people have to feed their families.
Yeah.
Whether you're building boats in America or building boats in the Netherlands, you know, there's a labor component and there's a people component. We got that.
Yeah.
The people component cannot be underestimated, and there's no better workforce in the world than the American workforce.
There you go.
When Sir Rolls, and I think there was a Sir Royce, and there were two, I think there were actually two people named Rolls and one named Royce, but their mantra was to their people, if you're not interested in being the best car mechanic in the world, you're in the wrong place.
Yeah, move on.
Because we're going to be building a car that there'll never be anything like it. And there still isn't.
Right.
You sit in a Rolls Royce, you're in a different world. You can sit in a Veyron or a Bugatti or some of these other things. They're nice. A Lamborghini, I recommend you buy one when you're young. Otherwise, you won't be able to get out of the damn thing once you're in it. They need a hoist. They need a
little,
you can make a lot of money. You need a personal hoist.
Make a little special car davit for the thing.
For people over 70, you know, to get them hoisted out of there. But I think that the people factor, and you hear it all the time in the art world, and it's true. My best example of the people factor and what it will lead to the surge of wonderful yachts built in America is a fellow that I met one time who he was in from the cold. It was cold in South Florida. He was in this interior of this very nice home. There's a party going on outside. It was a Seakeeper party. And I asked him what he did. He said he was a air conditioning repairman. I looked at his hands and I said, when's the last time you turned a wrench on an air conditioner? He said, about 25 years ago, probably 30, maybe 30 years. And then he said, maybe 50 years. I can't remember. But he owned the largest air conditioning service business in America. And he told me his children were now running it, as
cool.
It should be.
Yeah.
But he also said he loved yachting. And I said, do you have a yacht? He says, no, I charter.
See?
And I said, what do you love about it? He says, the people.
He said,
I love being on board those yachts. You know, he said, I just love the service. I love the attention. I love the expression of what I've created with my life. I'm happy about that. And you know, I really just enjoy talking to those kids when they're not working. If I can get them to pause for a minute and they feel comfortable stopping for 10 mm-hmm. minutes, they tell me their stories. He says, I love it. It's yachting. He says, that to me is yachting. He says, there's nothing like it.
There is nothing like it.
Yeah.
And I would tell you that, I would tell any crew member that you have to understand that you are working for people who have, at some level, found significant success in their life. Rare opportunity to sit with somebody who is successful that may be willing to basically point you in some directions or give you a good model of how you can be successful. It's a unique opportunity that hopefully enough of these yachties take advantage of, and you know, get that feedback. It'd be good.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think back when, you know, when you're in your 20s and even in your teens, the world in many ways is crystal clear. I mean, it's, you kind of know what your needs are and what your wants are. You really kind of know truly what your needs are and what your wants are. Now, probably the good news at that age is your parents are paying for it. But you do have this clarity of vision.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the great breakthroughs, when you talk to the people that said, you know, I was working on this, you see, whether it's Steve Wozniak or Sergey Brin or Larry Page, they were kids. You know, you look at Eric Schmidt and you say, Google, but he actually grew up like the rest of us. He went to school, went to Princeton. He was a smart guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Then he went to graduate school. I don't remember whether it was Stanford or University of California, I don't know, but that's where he went, met Wendy, the lovely Wendy Schmidt.
Yeah.
But you say, well, you know, you look at him now and you go, Google Wendy, Eric Schmidt. But when he started all that, he worked for 5 years without pay to create Google.
That's a commitment.
With Sergey Brin and Larry Page. And they were children. They were young children. They were not adults as we define them.
Well, you know, it's funny, the creative mind you have take you back.
When you're not worried about mortgages and children and all those sort of things yet.
John Lennon and Paul McCartney were in their late teens and early 20s when they started hitting gold.
Do you know they all broke up? They were still in their 20s when they
Isn't that crazy?
Broke up.
Yeah. Wow. So before we wrap up, because I want to make sure there's a couple things that we touch on, that sacred trinity, that sacred triad.
And what are the other two? Owners at the top.
Owners at the top. Well, I think they're all somewhat equal. Some owners might disagree with me.
Stool.
Like a three-legged stool. And arguably, we could put a fourth leg in there. I'll touch on that real quick, too. Number two, crew. I want to talk about crew. Number three, shipyards. We've been talking about shipyards. And now you kind of understand why I have a special place in love for shipyards in my maritime industry career and want to lift them up any way I can. And then you could go down the path that the fourth, what might be exactly what we're doing right now, sitting in a maritime attorney's office, the maritime law insurance package piece that really these boats have to have in this day and age to have an industry that's healthy. And I say everything else is the fluffy stuff. And what I mean by the fluffy stuff, it's like you could almost take anything else out of there and it would be replaced by some other way. There'd be another pathway to get done what you want to get done.
Right.
You could still have an industry. There's some brokers out there going, hey, what about us? And it's like, hey, you know, I'm a big advocate for good brokers doing a good job. But at the end of the day, you could do their job. You know, if two yacht owners wanted to conduct a transaction, they could come to your office and make that happen.
In that sense, you're right.
You know,
so you're talking about three legs of the stool. So you got the owners, you got the crew.
Yep.
Who was the other?
And the shipyards.
And the
shipyards are the refit yards, the shipyards, and even the marina infrastructure that lets you dock the boats and keep the boats someplace safe. It's the real estate piece and the construction support piece of it. Again, if you don't have them, you don't have a fleet. Your owner's not going to get his next boat. The charter yacht's not going to stay in service because it needs, you know, it just has to happen. And so they really need our respect and they need to be healthy. Because if they're healthy, the rest of the industry is healthy. If they're sick, the industry's suffering.
I think you're right. I think it also, your vantage point, it's interesting because you have the ownership, crew, yards, very different roles in the same industry, all vitally important. One of my mantras is hopefully equally as valid, which is that without the crew, without the captains, specifically in the crew, because they talk to the owners.
That's right.
So if the captain, the crew's wonderful, but to me, the most important group of people in the crew sector are the captains, obviously. They are, in fact, the masters. They are, in fact, the leaders.
The leaders,
they're
right.
They're the compass of the whole dog and pony show. Everything goes back to the happiness of the owner is based on the captain. And the captain's job is to just deal with that crew in a way that
right.
winnow it down, build it up, train it up, whatever. That's a massive factor in the owner's enjoyment. But the other crew, the other thing I want to say that I disagree with you a little bit on, but this may just be the which part of the elephant do you have your arm around, you know?
Right.
Are you holding the tail or the trunk or the legs? The brokers. I think that the problem in the brokerage world is that the internet and things like the internet have made it possible for completely incompetent people to get business.
Yeah.
But that is often the beginning of the end. Yeah, they can get business. They can go on the internet. They can flog that sucker and get, but then you get into the nightmare. Does the boat fit the owner? Mm-hmm. Does it fit the owner's needs? Does the draft fit his dock? Does the beam fit his channel? Does the way that the thing is configured fit his permissible uses or desired uses? Everything about the vessel should be reflecting the owner's desires and wishes,
yep,
wants, lifestyle. And that's just, you really see a lot of bad brokers out there. I mean, I think that the ones that are committed in the industry, mm-hmm, members of the International Yacht Brokers Association as a starting point,
yep,
not the ending point, but a starting point, committed to excellence. It goes right back to the Rolls-Royce mantra. They really drill down on what they do for a living. They've always been that way. When you talk to a Stuart Larson or a Kevin Merrigan, who we all know and love,
yep,
they are phenomenal brokers. They know, they not only answer all the questions that are asked, they pose all the questions that aren't asked and then answer them.
Well, that's important. I'd throw Mark Elliott into that group too.
Mark Elliott would be another good example.
And, you know, full disclosure, Bob Saxon, Paul Flannery are friends of mine going way back.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a lot of dear friends in the industry who are brokers, and you're absolutely right that the good brokers that are advocating for their client with the willingness to walk away from a deal if it's not right versus a deal at any cost. When I was doing management recently, we had a client that bought a boat. He thought it was perfect for the charter he wants to do, and it was not adequate. And, you know, the boat was sold to him with the knowledge that this client wanted to put this boat into charter. And there wasn't accommodations for crew sufficient to do the kinds of charter that they wanted to do.
There you go.
And, you know, so now he's having to Band-Aid the boat together, and he's frustrated, and, you know, he's not able to get the full charter revenue he otherwise would if it was the right boat. And, you know, you just look at things like that, and you say, well, you know, there's an example of a boat that needed to be sold, and somebody who wanted to buy a boat, and the two were brought together, and the buyer was convinced that he was buying what he needed, you know, and it was a pretty boat,
so
you know, yeah, what he thought. And some of these guys, as wealthy and successful as they are, they just don't know what they don't know, which is all right. Put me on Wall Street, I'd crash and burn in a second. I certainly don't know what I don't know. So different worlds.
There was a case that came to my office. Very clearly, the owner of the yacht was mad at the lawyer, the surveyor, and the broker.
Yeah.
And I told him, don't tell me any names, and then I'll decide if I can represent you. So he told me this. What his story was is that he bought a boat. None of those three groups, lawyers, surveyors, brokers, had looked at these certificates. Well, the second five-year survey was due in a year after he bought the boat. So now he's looking at several million dollars of expenditure that he's got to make if he wants to stay in class.
Yeah.
And he's mad. And he told me the name of the lawyer, the surveyors, and the brokers. And I said, I can't represent you. I know all three.
Well, that's part of the problem. This industry is so small.
They're good people.
Yeah. Well, and
but the problem is they did not do their job very well in this particular case. And depending on what his view is, it could not be a happy experience for them.
Well, there you go. And I've had that same experience in yacht management where we've had owners taking delivery and there's a pre-purchase survey. And you look at the pre-purchase survey and certain things just weren't done because the check boxes weren't checked, and mm-hmm, saved him $10,000-$15,000, and he spent, you know, six figures remediating things that could have and should have been picked
right
up. that's a whole other podcast.
Right, right.
And
there's a lot to talk about.
There is so much to talk about. I love it. So there's one more thing I do want to talk about.
Okay.
You and I share a love and participation in the International Sea Keeper Society.
Right.
I got involved in that a number of years ago just because I knew people like Spinner, Dick Seiden mm-hmm. Spinner, and yourself. And mm-hmm. it was, you know, to me, it was like perfect. I mean, here's some environmental and scientific initiatives that work. And you and I talked about this the other day. I'm very much an avid diver.
Yes,
I talked about
are.
My commercial diving, what people, some know, some don't. I'm a very accomplished cave diver. I go stupid distances back inside the wet rocks in zero photon environments on DPV scooters and staged bottles and have a lot of fun doing that. And I also go out in the ocean and mix a bunch of helium in my gas and go dive in deep wrecks and have a good time and get in decompression and all that kind of stuff. So my boat's named Surface Interval. That tells you everything you need to know, probably. So I have a passion for the ocean. And the Sea Keepers comes along, and the organization I was working with, Global Underwater Explorers, the only not-for-profit diving certification agency in the world, founded in Gainesville, by the way. Jared Jablonski, Robert Carmichael was involved.
Wow.
Kincaid.
Kincaid,
yeah. So
that the Kincaid is from Gainesville.
Yeah, he went
I know
to
that name
yeah,
from Gainesville.
Yeah, well,
sure,
and
yeah.
So he now lives out in Reno, Nevada, of all places.
Mm.
But they started an organization called Project Baseline.
Right.
And you and I talked about that.
Right.
And we're looking, and Project Baseline simply is citizen science. I'll just leave it at that, citizen science. I'll say that fast three times. Where anybody at all that dives, that wants to go in the water and participate has the opportunity to do so. It's a very simple program. You
right.
go in the water, you document where you are and when you're there. You document some simple things like how deep you were, what the water temperature was, what the visibility looks like. Ideally, you have your GoPro. You take some photos, shoot a little video if you can.
Oh, yeah.
And
I,
that information
project,
gets uploaded to
know,
a
you're
database.
Speaking
to
your audience, yeah.
No, that's all right.
That's true.
So what's that all about? What's that matter? Well, I've got three boys. They all dive. And when I started diving back in 1975,
right,
I went down to a place called Lou Key in the Keys.
Right.
Wow. It was a tropical wonderland. Just spectacular. My first impression was like, you know, I just drifted into heaven. I was recently doing a survey working with Project Baseline, and we went there and we did video transits and we did photo documentation. Dr. Todd Kincaid was with us. Robert Carmichael was on board too. We were on board the Baseline Explorer, an OSV converted ship that we were diving off of. And it looked like a frickin' desert.
Really?
Now, it's horrible. The staghorn coral, the elkhorn coral gone, algae everywhere. There were still pretty fish, but not like it was.
Mm.
There were clouds of fish. It was just, but I took my son, Tristan, to Lou Key a couple of years ago. We're making our way over to the Dry Tortugas, and we stopped there for a day of diving. He came out of the water going, "Wow, Dad, it's beautiful." Like, wow. Think about it. His perspective of that spot in the ocean, because he hadn't been there before and had no baseline to connect it to, was that, hey, it was pretty nice. My perception of the same spot was, it's a shit show. Wow, horrible.
Right.
You know, it's a freaking desert. And so when we talk about what's happening in the oceans and how we turn things around, step one is awareness. How are we going to get people
That's
aware
true.
Of what's happening? And Project Baseline is a simple way, very simple way to do it, where you can empower thousands, tens of thousands
yeah.
of people
yeah.
to get in the ocean and do that and start creating these comparisons. And, of course, my intention is to try to bring it to the yachting industry. You
Beautiful.
Teach crew how to do this. They reproduce themselves across multiple
Beautiful.
Boats.
So, yeah.
And you showed some interest, and Sea Keepers has its own initiatives. You talked about Seabed 2030 and... Give us some insight on your views.
First of all, I think Project Baseline is the beauty of it is the simplicity of it, which you can take a film, take a shot of a given moment in time and a given place in time, perfect coordinates of horizontal and, you know, and vertical, and also longitude and latitude and all
GPS the above. Numbers, yep.
All the above. So you get a perfect moment in time baseline of what you're dealing with. So I think that information is extremely valuable. You don't have to argue with the wackadoodles about whether this is happening or that's happening. You can say, look, you can either believe this or you can believe your own lying eyes. You know, it's just obvious.
Right.
But Sea Keepers is a multi, you know, I think it's like a lot of organizations. It's sort of the way you see it, and some of that is vision and some of it is reality and maybe some of everything in between. But I think that back in the vision of 1998 was different from the vision of 2024. I know that in 1998, the talk of Monaco was coral bleaching, and the talk of my clients, because I'd been, you know, been around for a number of, 1980, so, you know, do the math, and it was great. Life was grand, and I was in Monaco, and life was great. But the scourge being discussed in 1998 was coral bleaching and what was causing it. And half the people in the group was thought it was the earth was getting cold, and others thought the earth was getting warm. And they were shocked that the people at the table on the aft deck having sundowners was not in agreement on exactly what was going on. So a decision was made to address this question. The best way to start was to create this thing called the Sea Keeper 1000 unit.
Right.
It looked like a small refrigerator, but it was really only about a foot by a foot and about maybe 2.5 feet tall. It was a big piece of machinery that had kind of off-the-shelf components and sensors. And so we collected by drilling a through hole on a yacht's
Everybody
side.
Loves doing that, right?
Yeah. And having two through holes, one for intake and one for outtake or outpour. And, it was absurd in a certain way. These things cost $39,000 a piece. But I think in our naivety, you know, that didn't seem like a lot of money. And now it seems like, even today, it seems like a lot of money. But in those days, it was like, are you kidding me? I believe it is true, because I was there when I was walking down the dock, and I heard it with my own two ears. But the irony of this story is I am told that Sylvia Earle does not remember this moment in time. It was magic. She was asked, how can we make Sea Keepers better? This was the year 2008.
Okay.
So this was 10 years in. This was also the year of the great collapse.
Oh, yeah.
And in March of 2009, that nadir reached its ultimate before it started rising. A lot of the Sea Keeper core members had lost half of their wealth.
That hurts.
In just a matter of weeks.
Wow.
They weren't terribly, all of a sudden, they were not terribly interested in Sea Keepers. But, you know, other people, Sylvia Earle naming one, answered my question with, stop collecting your own data. Let the scientists collect the data. You just give them the ride.
Exactly.
It was genius, because it's like we're right in the middle of the yacht world.
Yeah.
It's like we have this global pasture of horses, and all you need to do is saddle up.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
That was the new orientation of Sea Keepers.
Brilliant.
It's ongoing. There's a success as 1,000 fathers and failure as an orphan. So people have a lot of new, they have revisionist ways of thinking about life in the big city. And things are, you know, there's a lot of beach cleanups. There's probably nothing more important that you can do in the world than clean up beaches. That's where the ocean meets the land. That's where the garbage collects.
Yeah, that's right.
Every day I get up and I see something that I think, I wish we could do that. I hope to get an initiative going inside Sea Keepers. I wrote down the words just a moment ago, Project Baseline.
There you go.
Because I hope to not just hear about it, but implement it. people are now searching for Amelia Earhart's airplane, spending millions and millions of dollars. But the irony of that is that they keep raising garbage.
In the middle of the ocean, that's Pacific right. Ocean, a speck.
So I think that could be a story.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about, I think I'm going to call it the Amelia Earhart Garbage Collection Initiative. Yeah, so it turns out that her contribution to science will not be that she tried to make it around the world, be the female, she'll be the woman who lit the fire of collecting ocean garbage. And it shall be forever her legacy.
Well, no, that would be a legacy. Absolutely.
And so that's something we're working on. We're working on, these are projects that are just beginning. These
right.
are the nascent ideas that we now have to figure out how to implement them. The unreported illegal and illicit fishing.
Oh, goodness.
It's a scourge. Most of the world, now if you talk to a lot of the world scientists, including Sylvia Earle, she's total vegan. Don't eat seafood. Don't eat animal food. Don't eat land food. Eat plant-based diet, vegetarian. Okay, fine. And I'm all on board with that, except that I know that the world's most of the protein available to the poorest people on the planet comes from the ocean. There's lots of places that don't have enough land to farm or not enough land to ranch, and that one place would be Monaco.
Right, right.
You don't have any cows in Monaco, no cornfields. You have rocks.
And pavement.
But you had a guy, Albert the First, who had a vision. So you're going to have a little vision here. And so I think that sometimes when you embrace something, you actually make it better. We are involved in a project for growing stone crabs. It's a farming operation.
Yeah.
Sustainable farming. I think that you're not going to convince people to stop eating stone crabs. They're going to eat stone crabs. But this client of mine is growing stone crabs, and he grows them vastly faster than they grow in the wild, and safer, and they're healthier, and they multiply, and it's a wonderful product.
Right.
But I got a call only yesterday from a manufacturer of sunscreen in California. It's non-toxic. Sunscreen, that little sunscreen that people use, is totally toxic and kills on contact a lot of the little coral fish, the reef fish.
That's true.
And, you know, these are things that people like yourself would know because this is your world, but most of the world doesn't understand that the people slathering up in Rio right now.
They don't care. They're unaware.
They don't know.
It's not that they don't care. They're just, right.
So there's a lot of these projects. When you say, what does Sea Keepers do? We do stuff, shark tagging, promote eating of lionfish.
Yeah, yum.
Testing. There's a study going on of sea slugs, which are these gelatinous-looking things that are just—they have all kinds of powers.
Yeah, and
they have regenerative powers. They regenerate. They communicate. If you slice a sea slug in half, separate the two pieces, and then move them like around, suddenly they'll
find each other. Crazy, isn't it?
And how do you do that?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there's projects of regenerating limbs like stone crabs. How do they do that? You know, growing bivalves off every... If you could do, like, one of my friends and clients, he's actually the son of Lawton Childs, the great governor.
Yeah.
Woman who did that painting is Rhea Childs, his mother.
Oh, cool.
But Lawton Childs was a great governor and a great senator of the state of Florida, in my view. His son, Bud, has a project called All Clams on Deck. And All Clams on Deck, among other things, just understands that bivalves will purify 50 gallons of water every day.
That's right.
And you can grow bivalves off your dock. Every dock in Florida can have a oyster farm.
Yeah.
So all of these things are just, there's 1,000 points of light, to quote George Bush.
Yeah.
And that's the approach as far as I'm concerned. It's, if we can be helpful and we can figure out some answers, we just move forward. It's almost like a glacier. It'll destroy anything in its path, but you won't see it even moving.
There you go. Well, I would say that in some circles, International Seakeeper Society is one of our industry's best-kept secrets. And hopefully conversations like this will put a spotlight on it, and we will start seeing more awareness of what Seakeepers does. And then, you know, it's an inclusive organization. You just have to, you know, have an interest to be included.
Right.
And I managed to worm my way in a few years ago, and I'm so glad that I did. And, you know, it's something that I would tell anybody that's listening to this podcast right now. Google it, look it up, take a look at what International Seakeepers Society does and is. And if you have the wherewithal to help fund it or donate a yacht to the organization, it's a great way the Seakeepers Society creates revenue. Consider it. And yeah, Michael, I think this is just an opportunity to, again, hold up our industry and do what we need to do to make it a better, healthier industry.
It's a yacht-centric environmental organization that without yachts, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Our founders were yachtsmen, six yachtsmen. First one in the door was the great Alex Dreyfus.
How about that?
God rest his soul, who had six motor yachts. He was a wonderful yachtsman up in Palm Beach.
Right, right.
Number two guy in the door was Paul Allen, one of the greatest yachtsmen that ever lived. He had three motor yachts. And you could tell he was in love with yachting in so many different ways. He did so many things that were yacht-related. He was a wonderful archaeologist. He just, the archaeology of the ocean, loved the, you know, he loved exploring these. He found old ships that had sunk.
Isn't that great?
Military vessels that had sunk.
Yep.
He found old Grecian, the straits between Tunisia and that part of Africa and Malta and that area. It's just littered with sunken vessels. It's a rough body of water. That's all that water goes through there, through that strait. And a lot of ships didn't make it in the old days. They're falling apart. They're overburdened. They're overstowed, overloaded.
They didn't have ISM compliance back then.
No, they didn't have plimsoll marks.
No, they didn't.
And so you go down there, and the seabed is just littered with urns and things that carried olive oil and all this, the material of the day.
That's so cool.
And the oil of the day. And that was a Paul Allen thing. He died at 65.
Way too early.
He was on a roll on so many different levels. I ran into a guy that told me that the Black Sea is probably going to prove to be the most fascinating place on planet Earth because it probably was the biblical scene of the Great Flood, and it was a valley full of people and civilizations. And when that isthmus broke, it filled up what?
Sediment and silt.
Sure, just like the isthmus between Gibraltar. Obviously, we all know that at some point that broke and
boom.
You got what we call the Mediterranean.
Yep.
But the Black Sea is so deep that the water is so cold at the bottom. I'm
preserved.
Told,
it's all preserved.
Yeah. It's all down there.
Yeah.
And at some point, probably not anytime real soon, but they're going to be people. I think yachtsmen are the great new, you know, Magellan.
Yeah.
You know, De Gama, Christopher Columbus, all the great explorers. I'm sorry for the left, those of you who don't like Christopher Columbus.
Hey, he's real.
He's a real deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Deal. Yeah, but I mean, that's going to be I think a lot of yachtsmen are kind of doing that in a different way. They go where they want to go.
Yeah.
That's why Seabed 2030 is so important. Because yachtsmen go where the hell they want to go.
Right, so we get to map more of the seabed and see what's down there and see what it looks like and what the contours are. And yeah, it's good stuff. So ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of Yachting USA. I am your host, Rick Thomas. We're sitting again with Michael Moore of Moore & Company. I hope you enjoyed this conversation and we'll tune in for future conversations. Until we see each other again, I wish you all well.
If your brand belongs in the heart of the yachting world, this is where it happens. Yachting International Radio reaches over 1 million yachting professionals and enthusiasts every month with 77 million impressions, 220,000 social followers, and 74,000 podcast subscribers. Our hosts are insiders, crew, captains, CEOs, trusted voices shaping the industry. This is targeted, high-impact advertising in a luxury niche. Visit yachtinginternationalradio.com/advertise. Your audience is already listening.